ओम ज्ञानति निरंधस्य ज्ञानं जनशनाथाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Translation. O son of Pritha, do not yield to this degrading impotence. It does not become you. Give up such petty weakness of heart and arise, O chastiser of the enemy. Purport. Arjun was addressed as the son of Pritha, who happened to be the sister of Krishna's father Vasudeva. Therefore, Arjuna had a blood relationship with Krishna. If the son of a Kshatriya declines to fight, he is a Kshatriya in name only. And if the son of a Brahmana acts impiously, he is a Brahmana in name only. Such Kshatriyas and Brahmanas are unworthy sons of their fathers. Therefore, Krishna did not want Arjuna to become an unworthy son of a Kshatriya. Arjuna was the most intimate friend of Krishna, and Krishna was directly guiding him on the chariot. But in spite of all these credits, if Arjuna abandoned the battle, he would be committing an infamous act. Therefore, Krishna said that such an attitude in Arjuna did not fit his personality. Arjuna might argue that he would give up the battle on the grounds of his magnanimous attitude for the most respectable Bhishma and his relatives. But Krishna considered that sort of magnanimity mere weakness of heart. Such false magnanimity was not approved by any authority. Therefore, such magnanimity or so-called non-violence should be given up by persons like Arjuna under the direct guidance of Krishna. This is a call to battle by Lord Krishna to his dear friend Arjuna, the great fighter, who Krishna is insulting him. That's one way to get people to fight, to insult them. What are you? You're just a useless. What will you, when you, later in life, when your grandson sits on your lap before the fire and asks you, what did you do in the Great War? And you said, well, I was shoveling cow dung in Minnesota. It won't impress your grandson. That was part of General Patton's call to fight, call to charge into machine gun fire, which he fired up his soldiers to do that. So you have to be quite motivational to get people to charge into almost certain death. So Krishna is similarly followed the same pattern. That if you don't fight, you're just useless. You're not a man. You're not a man and you're not a woman either. Kleibya is the state of being a eunuch. Krishna was insulting Arjuna, reminding him, hey, you were a eunuch before. He had to become a eunuch. So for 1 year, due to the curse of Urvashi, that she thought, you're not, I want you to enjoy with me, sorry. Oh, you're not a man, you should become a eunuch. So he became a eunuch for 1 year, which was useful actually, because then he wasn't discovered in the court of Maharaj Virat. No one could imagine that the dancing instructor of his Maharaj Virat's daughter could be Arjuna, Brihannala. So it was a bit, Krishna's reminder, you want to be like that again? I'm God, I can make you into a eunuch again if you want. You want to be like that? Don't be like that. What a curse for a kshatriya, for a fighting man. They couldn't be anything worse. So Krishna's inciting him to fight. The very good Arjuna, he didn't accept Urvashi's invitation because he was guided by dharma, that I do not desire to enjoy with you because you are the mother of our dynasty. Many generations back, she's in the heavenly planets. So the time scale is different. So he was guided by dharma, and due to considerations of dharma, he thought it's not good to fight here, because violence in general is not good, but it requires to be used in human society. The kshatriya class must be there who employ violence to stop worse violence. That's why we have the anomaly of United Nations peacekeeping forces still in Bosnia. Not much to do nowadays, but they keep the peace by shooting people. Or the threat of shooting people prevents them from indiscriminately and unrighteously attacking others. So righteous violence is employed to stop worse violence, and that's the whole reason why Krishna wanted Arjuna to fight, or why he orchestrated the war, is that Duryodhana was ruling the kingdom to exploit the situation for his own sense gratification, in this way spoiling the whole society, even though superficially he might have been ruling the kingdom in a fairly reasonable manner. We don't hear stories of Duryodhana torturing the citizens or imposing unnecessary taxes on them. Just the fact that he wasn't a devotee of Krishna spoiled the whole society, even if superficially he ruled it in a fair way, because the whole society is supposed to center. The king is he collects all the, and he orchestrates all the activities of the society for offering to Krishna. This Sve Sve Karma Nibhirata Sangsitim Labhate Naraha. By following one's own work, everyone can achieve perfection. So that's in the Varnashram society, which is orchestrated or organized by the king so that everyone engages in yajna. By yajna, all the fruits of everyone's endeavors are formally offered to Vishnu. But Duryodhana, even if he superficially organized such sacrifice, just like Shukracharya was organizing Bali Maharaj to perform sacrifice in yajna, in which the yajnapati or the yajna book, the lord of sacrifice, the enjoyer of sacrifice, is Vishnu. But actually he was against the spirit of offering to Vishnu, as became clear when Vishnu personally appeared and wanted to take everything from Bali Maharaj. So Shukracharya, his offering to Vishnu was superficial and therefore not pleasing to him, to Lord Vishnu. So in the same way, Duryodhana, he might have ruled the kingdom in a, what from the humanistic perspective might have seemed to be fair, but because he was against the spirit of service to Vishnu, the whole endeavor of the society could not have helped them to advance in Krishna consciousness. So to stop this exploitation, that people would have to serve a king who had appropriated the kingdom by unfair means. So all their offerings to the king became, instead of sharing in the punya or the pious activities of the king, just by doing their regular varnashram duties, instead of becoming purified, they would have to share in Duryodhana's sin. So to save them from all this, there are many reasons, of course, why Krishna orchestrated that the battle of Kurukshetra should take place. The main reason is Bhubhara Haran, taking away the unnecessary, removing the unnecessary burden of the earth, the burden of unrighteous Kshatriyas. So Arjuna was the principal instrument. Krishna later told him, Nimittamatram bhava Savyasachi. Savyasachi, Arjuna, you are to be an instrument only in my plan of wiping out this unnecessary burden of Kshatriyas on the earth. They become, if they're not Krishna conscious, they become a burden, because they're a dynamic people, if they're energetic, who direct the society. So if they're not properly performing their duties or properly motivated, then the whole society becomes misguided, just like I gave the example with Duryodhana. So it becomes a great burden on society, and Krishna wanted to remove that, and his main instrument for his main arena for doing so was the battlefield of Kurukshetra. And the main person who was to do that was Arjuna. So violence was required. But Arjuna, at this hour, Vishame Samupastitam, in this present, in this terrible moment, he became a philosopher. He wanted to become non-violent. Not that he was against, he knew the principle of violence, for righteous violence. He understood that principle, but he didn't feel that it was properly applied in this instance, for so many reasons which he gives. That we should not attack our gurus. We should not leave the women folk unprotected, which would happen if all the Kshatriyas are killed. Then we shouldn't destroy our family. So he had so many reasons for not fighting. But Krishna is immediately insulting him, stinging him into action. You eunuch. You don't want to fight? Get up. Give up this weakness. It's just weakness of heart. You're thinking this is strength of character to refuse the fight, but I'm telling you it's weakness of heart, just the opposite. So he's inciting Arjuna to fight, and this has come under criticism ever since. That why, if you say Krishna is God, and he's saintly, and he's good, and he's merciful, and he cares for everyone, then why does he incite Arjuna to fight when Arjuna had Arjuna by himself had come to a higher perspective that fighting is not good. However, Srila Prabhupada in the purport refers to so-called nonviolence and false magnanimity. That so-called violence is based on false magnanimity, a false understanding. Magnanimity means a spirit of generosity towards others. In this world, everyone thinks in terms of I, me, and mine. And violence is perpetrated on others it's generally understood that violence is perpetrated upon others for the sake of advancing one's own self-interest. Therefore, a magnanimous person, he should be non-violent by principle. However, Srila Prabhupada speaks of so-called non-violence. What does Srila Prabhupada mean by so-called non-violence? Violence, it's clear what it means. Violence means to attack others, to inflict pain on them. Generally, that's considered to be by using weapons or one's fists and inflicting bodily pain. It can also mean that there's verbal violence, verbal abuse, which causes mental pain. That, as is stated in Mahabharata, that the words, the sharp words of loved ones hurt more than the enemy's arrows. It hurts more. Actually, one who is very close to one has the ability to hurt one more. The arrow of an enemy is accepted by a kshatriya with pleasure. The king has to go out at the front of the battle. Not that he's sitting by his telephone 10,000 miles away. Go on there, men. But he's out there, and if he doesn't, he has to come back at least with some wound on his body. That's his medal. They didn't have medals. The medal was the scars. So the pain of a weapon inflicted by an enemy is not as painful as the sharp words of one who one loves, who is close to one. Why is that? Because violence is measured in terms of pain. Violence means to inflict pain upon others. So, therefore, non-violence is a very good principle. Non-violence means not to inflict pain upon others. To inflict pain upon others means to be envious of others. And envy is not good. It's just the opposite of love. So, non-violence is the principle of non-violence is synonymous with love. Don't harm others. If you can't love others, at least don't harm them. So then what does Prabhupada mean by so-called non-violence? It should be clear that violence means to inflict pain upon others, either by weapons or by words, or by behavior. Sometimes no words can be more painful than words. If you just refuse to speak to someone, that's also can be one kind of violence. It's not sharp violence, but it's painful nevertheless. It's not. So, how is it that Krishna is recommending violence? Krishna, who is known as the friend of all living beings, Suhridam, the very best friend of all living beings, and Arjuna, out of his broad-heartedness, out of his consideration for others, does not want to fight. But Krishna is telling him, you should fight, you're useless. He didn't call him a woman, which is an insult for a man. But he called him a eunuch. You're like a eunuch. That's even worse. That's the worst insult for a kshatriya. Hridaya daurbalyam, weakness of heart. Generally, the kshatriyas, they're addressed as lion heart or tiger, heart like a tiger. Purusha vyagra. Krishna elsewhere addresses him as tiger among men. Here he's addressing, you got a weak heart. It's like you say that, oh, you're not fit for battle because you're too, you'll faint. That actually happened when we were talking about Virat Maharaj. Then when Arjuna drove him out on the chariot to face the Kauravas who had stolen their cow, Arjuna was the chariot driver, and the young prince was going out, and he fainted, and Arjuna had to get him up and, look, don't worry, I'm Arjuna. I'll look. Oh, really? Okay, let's go. Otherwise, he fainted out of fear. So to be called weak-hearted for a kshatriya, that wasn't Arjuna's motive. It wasn't that he was afraid. He'd been in many that battle with the Kauravas. He'd already defeated all of them by himself. He'd already done it just less than a year previously. So he wasn't afraid, and he wasn't doubting his abilities. But nevertheless, Krishna is saying that your lack of understanding, your whole approach shows that you're weak-hearted, don't understand the actual situation. So how is this that violence is, at least in some circumstances, considered better than non-violence? It's not that by citing Bhagavad Gita one can justify random violence in any situation. Bhagavad Gita doesn't justify Hitler or Bush or any of these violent attacks upon others. But fighting for the sake of upholding dharma, this is being recommended. That, again, the point, what is the purpose of the kshatriya caste? To protect from hurt. That if one is violent, if violence is applied in the proper time, place, and circumstance, that saves much more violence. That was actually the American justification for Hiroshima and Nagasaki dropping the atom bombs. They said, well, if the war, this will stop the war, and if we hadn't dropped them, then the war would have gone on much longer and many more people would have been killed. So they were using the same logic. So kshatriya does that. It's just like the police, that some criminal is there, he'll break into your home and kill all your family, kill you and your family members and steal everything. So in Texas there's a law that if anyone comes on your property without asking any questions, you can shoot him dead. It's presumed that anyone who comes is coming with a bad motive. Maybe it's a hangover. Maybe there's a leftover from the cowboy days. So that's allowed. That violence to protect, violence for protection of one's valid rights, is considered acceptable. One disciple was telling me that in Hyderabad in South India, it's one thieves' techniques. There's the air conditioner box. They take it out and they enter the building through that. So he told me this happened in his brother's house, and his brother with two shots killed two intruders. So I said, well, there must have been a police case. He said, yeah, there's no problem though. So we know the police. They're our relatives, so the top people. So violence, well applied, is, we can see, if it have allowed the wrong, yes, non-violence, please come and kill us all and take all our possessions. And that will encourage, even if you think that's a good idea, then that will encourage more and more violence. It'll be simply chaos. Just like when Vaina Maharaj was killed by the Brahmanas because of his torture of the citizens, they found that then the thieves who up to that time had been in fear of Vaina Maharaj, then they came out and the situation became even worse. That he was bad, but at least Vaina Maharaj was bad, but at least he served some function of, he kept everyone in fear. So at least you knew where the violence was coming from. But with the thieves, it was just complete anarchy. And any time, day or night, for no reason, you can be attacked and pillaged and looted. I saw that when I was living in Bangladesh. There was one dictator, and although it didn't come in the news, he killed his political enemies left, right, and center. One time, I was told actually when I happened to visit the British Embassy, the intelligence officer who was drunk told me so many things which he shouldn't have told me. So he suppressed his political enemies, which a dictator does. But at the same time, there was more or less some kind of law and order in the state. But then when they brought in democracy, every day there were strikes and riots, and there was no clear leader. All the politicians were busy running around and thinking how to exploit the state. So instead of one person exploiting the state, there was 200 or 300 of them. And none of them had any time or power to actually take charge. And for political purposes, they wanted the demonstrations. It was a much better situation under one corrupt dictator rather than having 200 or 300 corrupt people who couldn't control anything. We're not recommending it's good to have a corrupt dictator, but at least in my experience, in that situation, it seemed better than having a so-called democracy. And eventually another dictator came in anyway. And the first one was better. The one they killed. And then anyway, let's not talk about Bangladeshi politics too much. But anyway, it gives an idea that some force is required. We use the term anarchy to talk about some chaotic situation, but actually the philosophy, the political philosophy of anarchy is based on the wildly incorrect assumption that people are basically good and you don't need any government, we'll just live without any government. Well, that was true in the Satya Yuga, but not now. If there's no government now, then what happens? It becomes chaotic, and then eventually someone grabs power who's more powerful, who's the most ruthless. So that's why Kshatriyas are required in society. They're not ruthless, they don't desire power for their own sake, but they're powerful and they take charge. They have Ishvara Bhava, they feel I'm in charge. They know how to take charge and they do take charge, but they do so on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they have a higher principle and they're guided by Brahmanas. So that kind of violence is required in human society. Prabhupada himself said, he was in Delhi in 1971 when the Pakistan invaded India. And Delhi is not far from the Pakistan border. So in Delhi especially, they get really afraid when there's any tension between India and Pakistan. What to speak if they invade? A few years ago, everyone was sure there's going to be another India-Pakistan war. It seemed that I was getting letters from the though the American embassy was sending to American citizens, leave India immediately. Devotees were getting letters, and one god brother writing to me from America saying, leave immediately. And so in Delhi, people were really afraid. I was in South India. No one cared in the slightest because they knew if there's an India-Pakistan war, anyway, India wins eventually, and we won't get affected. We're far enough away from it all. So they didn't care. So Prabhupada was in Delhi, and a newspaper reporter asked him that, well, what do you think? Should we fight? For the newspaper reporters, that kind of question they like to ask. It's like putting the sadhu on the spot. Is he going to be, sadhu means he should be like Mahatma Gandhi. No violence. When Prabhupada said, yes, they should fight. They should defeat them. They should fight. And as Prabhupada said, if you're fighting in a war, you don't fight half-heartedly. Like all the you just go in and you fight to win. Do whatever is required to win. So, another time Prabhupada was in Punjab, and he was in the home of a Raja, a king. He was in a king's palace. And there were several heads of tigers. And Prabhupada said, the heads of tigers, they mount them on the wall. And the Raja said, I shot them myself. And Prabhupada said, oh, really? Very good. He appreciated that. He appreciated the Kshatriya spirit. Shooting a tiger doesn't mean that the tiger was in a cage. He was out in the forest, and you have to be a Kshatriya to look a tiger in the face when he's not in a cage. He wants to kill you. It's frightening. Even when they are in a cage, it's frightening. Want to speak, you have to face them. So Prabhupada appreciated that. Of course, nowadays it's illegal because there's hardly any tigers left, but still they come out sometimes and kill the villagers. So that's why the Kshatriyas, that's one of their duties, to trim down the population of tigers, because they tend to eat human beings. So Prabhupada appreciated, that's one of the jobs of a Kshatriya, to protect from hurt. In the in Africa, there's that famous tribe. What's that called? No, not Zulu. Another one in East Africa. Huh? Maasai. Yeah. So there, the Maasai's, previously the to be accepted as a man in the Maasai tribe, a young boy had to fight with and kill a lion. That's after that you're allowed to get married. Then you're accepted as a man. And even today the Maasai, they walk around and the lions won't go anywhere near them. They know they're afraid of them. Fight with means you're allowed to use a spear. No, you're not hand to hand, but they had to fight. So that's more meaningful than your cartoon Superman. Imagined hero. So Prabhupada appreciated that Kshatriya spirit there. That they were capable of and had the spirit to fight for the right cause. Now, non-violence is worshipped. It's considered a very high quality. This Buddha Dev, he taught the principle Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. Non-violence is the topmost religion. And Buddhism is considered a very gentle and good religion. Often people mistake our Hare Krishna devotees for Buddhists. And here too, they say, generally they say, you're Buddhist. That's why, actually, in England, where people are, there's a very kind of violent mood, the macho mood. So, we found that people often appreciated us much more. What happened, we go out on Harinam in our dhotis, and they say, who are these people dressed? They're men dressed as women. They say, ugh, what's that? And then some of them would attack us physically, and then devotees loved that. They get their cartels and beat them on the head till they bled, and then people, oh. Then they appreciated the devotees. But generally people say Buddhism, yeah, very nice, very, very peaceful religion, is no violence. The Dalai Lama is considered like a symbol in the West. He seems to spend most of his life in the Western world, basking in the exaltation of being a symbol of the peaceful East, although he's a big meat eater himself, like most Buddhists. At least in traditional Buddhist countries, most of the Buddhists are meat eaters, which just goes to show how the principles of any religion are always distorted by persons who want sense gratification. And how can it be that Buddhists are meat eaters? But the point is, they say that non-violence is the highest religion, so we are non-violent. We are strict Buddhists. We will never, ever dream of killing any animal. However, there are Muslims, and they kill the animals, and we purchase the meat from them. So what's wrong with that? They get the sin, and we are strictly non-violent. And this is why the small Muslim population in Thailand, a Buddhist country where I used to live, is a very, very important part of the population, because everyone's a meat eater. Or in Christianity, they say, well, violence is bad. This Bush has invaded Iraq because Saddam is very bad. He's violent to his citizens. He's torturing them. But in Christianity and in Islam and Judaism, the Semitic religions, if they have made a logical hole in their way of thinking, that violence to human beings is very bad, but violence to animals is okay. Nothing wrong with that. It doesn't count. Because according to Christianity, animals don't have souls. So even though they keep the slaughterhouses away from the cities, a long way, so that people can't hear the animals screaming, and they don't see the blood and the terror of the animals, they rationalize that, well, they're only animals, so there's no harm in killing them. But there's the whole reason they're thinking that violence is bad is because it causes pain and suffering. And the animals clearly experience pain and suffering, but because people are more interested in their own sense gratification, therefore they say, yeah, we believe in non-violence, but only to humans. They just overlook and the fact that animals clearly suffer pain. Prabhupada, you can see there's that film of Prabhupada speaking with Cardinal Daniello. And Prabhupada, he's angry. He's talking to him. He's pounding his fist on his knee. How can you say the animals have no soul? They also feel pain. That was the point Prabhupada is making. You're killing them. They feel pain. They have consciousness. That is the center of the soul. And you're giving them pain. That is sinful. So they invented this idea in Christianity that animals have no souls because, and they suppressed the fact that Jesus himself was a vegetarian because they want to eat animals. So it serves as an example of how even the highest principles of any religion, that people are so-called religionists, are so shameless that they'll completely twist them around for their own sense gratification. Sadhu sabdhan. We have to be careful. We don't do the same things ourselves. Christianity means you keep a picture of Jesus and you do whatever you damn like. And you say, we believe in Jesus. And we just believe in Jesus and he will save us. So we have to be careful. We don't do the same thing. We keep a picture of Prabhupada and we believe in Prabhupada and you don't do anything he says. And you reinterpret everything he says. And you say, well, that was for that time, but now it's something else. And in this way, you keep Prabhupada as a mascot and do whatever you like. There's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So he gave an interesting example in this regard. If you criticize people for falsely showing symptoms of ecstasy, crying, falling on the ground, and some false displays of ecstasy were said, well, Lord Chaitanya, he did that. So we should also do that. And then afterwards you see them eating fish, as is common among Bengali Vaishnavas, and you say that, well, Lord Chaitanya never did that. Well, that's Lord Chaitanya, and who are we? And he's Lord Chaitanya. He's so great. We're just ordinary beings. We can't follow that. So you follow the things you imitate the things you're not supposed to do, and you don't follow what you are supposed to do. And it's all in the name of Lord Chaitanya. So this is cheating religion. So Prabhupada is Krishna, and Prabhupada following Krishna is pointing out what is the proper understanding of violence and non-violence? That by being violent, one can uphold non-violence. And by that means that if one is violent to protect, to stop rascals exploiting others, then that is actual non-violence. But if one is non-violent in a situation where violence is required, then that is violence. To not act in a manner that will, if one has the ability to protect others but doesn't do so, then that is actually violence. And that brings us to the higher understanding of what is violence and non-violence. That the actual manner in which we can benefit others is to give knowledge of Krishna. And if we fail to do that, then we are committing the greatest violence. If we have knowledge of Krishna by which people can be saved from the pain of repeated birth and death, and we don't give that, or if we obstruct that, or if we distort that, then that is violence. Because we're acting in a manner which is detrimental to the benefit of others. If a Kshatriya, as Arjuna is pointing out here, if a Kshatriya is in a position to fight to protect others but fails to do so, that is far, his non-violence is grossly sinful. Whereas his violence in that situation is a highly pious activity by which he attains the heavenly planets. The brahmanas attain the heavenly planets by following their brahminical duties, being peaceful. The same heavenly planets are attained very easily by the kshatriyas if they sacrifice their life fighting to protect the principles of religion. So, actual violence means not to preach Krishna consciousness. The worst violence is to withhold knowledge of Krishna consciousness. That's why, although we definitely Hitler is cited, he has a unique place in history. He's cited as a great demon. In many ways, there's not that much difference between the average Joe Schmidt, or whatever they're called in Croatia, and Hitler. Because we're all in, everyone is violent, even the so-called non-violent person. By promoting an idea that we shall all live peacefully together in this world. Imagine all the people living for today, and all this kind of thing. The person who sung that got shot dead, as you know, John Lennon. He was a great advocate of non-violence. Mahatma Gandhi also, proponent of, but actually he was, what his proposition was violent to the British. They didn't want to leave India, and he wanted to force them out. Force, either by physical force or by economic force. So he was espousing. And again, Mahatma Gandhi, he made a gross mistake. Because of Mahatma Gandhi's nonsense, there's so much blood, so much violence took place in India. One thing was, after Indian so-called independence, the people thought, well, now at last we have Hindustan, so now we'll stop animal killing, the cow killing. The Muslims were doing it, the British were doing it, but Mahatma Gandhi said, no, the Muslims, you have to respect their religion, you have to allow them to kill cows. And the Hindus were so stupid that they respected Mahatma Gandhi so much. Oh, we have to go along with what he says. So every cow that's killed in India, then Mahatma Gandhi, wherever he is, he's going on getting karma for that. And what happened was, after that, all the arsenal of weapons when the British left was in India, not in the newly created state of Pakistan. And all the money was with India. It was all in Delhi. And Pakistan was a new state with no weapons and no money. And the people like Sardar Patel, they thought, well, this is great. Now we'll just take them over. But Mahatma Gandhi said, no, you have to be fair. Give them their fair share. They gave them their fair share. They organized their army and they attacked India. So his non-violence and fairness was again based on the foolish assumption that everyone is basically good. You treat them nicely and they'll be nice with you. Foolish. By his foolishness, he caused so much violence. That's why I sometimes say, and if it gets found out, I'll probably be banned from going back to India, that this Naturam Godse, who shot Mahatma Gandhi, he made a great mistake. He did a very wrong thing. He waited so much time to shoot him. Should have done it much sooner. Anyway, that's my joke. We don't advocate shooting people in general. Not, but I mean, actually, the point is that by his so-called non-violence, because he didn't understand the principles of religion. Violence applied not according to the principles of religion is horrible. It's disaster in human society. And non-violence, also, if one doesn't understand the principles of religion and applies non-violence, that's also a disaster. It both works out to be disaster for human society. So real non-violence means that if we have knowledge of Krishna and we don't preach that and we don't apply that in, if we don't give that to others, then that is the worst violence. Hitler and everyone else on the same level, because they're all violently misusing their human lives and that of others. By not preaching Krishna consciousness, we do more harm than Hitler did. Hitler simply killed the bodies. But if we kill the spiritual opportunity, then that is a worse violence. So people say Hitler is very bad because they have the envious idea that we should enjoy this material world separately from Krishna. Why should anyone interfere with that? But that in itself is the idea that we should live happily in this world is based on envy of Krishna. And the inevitable result is violence, sometimes gross in the form of wars and fist fights and verbal fights. But otherwise it's going on all the time. Everyone who is not Krishna conscious, there, every dealing with every other person is based on the principle of what I get from this person. How can I exploit them? And because of the envy, one person wants to put down another person. So it's a world of violence because everyone is envious, everyone is exploiting everyone else. We come out to Lika to see the beautiful nature. But the beautiful nature is all living. Jiva, jivasya, jivanam, all different living beings are struggling. Even the plants are fighting with each other for space and light. So it's a violent world because the whole principle is based on the grossly derelict principle. The whole principle of the material world is based on the principle of envying Krishna, which spills out, overflows from time to time as gross violence. So one who understands the principles of religion, that society should be regulated so that people can either directly or gradually take to the path of Krishna consciousness and to uphold that paradigm, violence, like that which Krishna was exhorting Arjuna to take to. That kind of violence is actually non-violence. Whereas the idea of non-violence, that we shall all live happily in this world and we'll all be peaceful, it is at the very best a naive dream. And actually, necessarily causes violence, and then it is itself violence in as much as it fortifies the envious idea of enjoying this world separately from Krishna. So the real non-violence means if we are to act not just neutrally by not assaulting others, but acting in a manner which is for their ultimate benefit, which means to act in a manner that others can take to Krishna consciousness, preaching Krishna consciousness. So here, this is just one of the many positions which Srila Prabhupada took, the Vedic position on the basis of self-realization, on the basis of Shastra. Prabhupada spoke so many things which are totally opposed to the modern violent way of thinking. People think in the modern age, the really enlightened, they call the enlightenment, the age in which people stop believing in scripture in the Western world. And they think that the pinnacle of that was the motto of the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité, which ended up in the guillotine in the name of fraternité. We love you so much. But and then after that came Napoleon, who brought the whole French people and the whole of Europe to war. But people think the principle, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity, but it doesn't work. It cannot work in a world in which everyone they want the liberty to despise Krishna and act independently of Krishna. They want that we'll all have equal rights to be envious of Krishna, and we're all brothers without recognizing the Supreme Father, Krishna. So it must end up in more and more violence. So Prabhupada, he was speaking Bhagavad Gita to the hippies at the time of the Vietnam War, where they all believed in peace. Give peace a chance. Make love, not war. That was their motto. Why are we fighting in Vietnam? They believed in peace. They didn't want, why should you go to war and shoot people in Vietnam and get worse still, get shot by them? The men didn't want to go to war because they wanted to stay home and enjoy the women. Yeah. And the women didn't want the men to go to war because then who are they going to enjoy with? Of course, nowadays, they send the women too because it's women's rights. You also have the right to shoot people. You know, people you've got no, you have nothing against them or for, just someone decided we should have a war with them. So the women can also go into a village and kick open the doors and shoot everyone dead. And our loving mothers, 2006, we advanced from the previous generation. So they wanted, Prabhupada was preaching non-violence. So he was preaching that non-violence of Arjuna was despicable. In the example he was giving, because he was giving, teaching Bhagavad Gita. But for the hippies, it was the more, you know, it wasn't something they could very easily relate to. As they believe, but why, you know, why go and fight? We should come home in a box with an American flag draped over it. So, but why? You know, we're young, we should enjoy ourselves. But Prabhupada is saying, no. It's fighting of Arjuna was required. He also noted that the condition of the American military, that they're drafting Shudras. The draft means they're not drafting Kshatriyas. They're people of Shudra mentality. And how are they going to fight? They have no spirit to fight. A Kshatriya, Sukhina Kshatriya Partha Labhante Yudhamidrisham. A real Kshatriya is very happy to get the opportunity to fight. He wants to. But the Shudras, they hate. Oh, they want to. They just want to enjoy themselves. So this is one of the many stances that Srila Prabhupada took in his preaching, because he was preaching the actual situation, it was actually for the welfare of human society. Nowadays we have a term PC, politically correct. Prabhupada wasn't politically correct. So many things. He was against democracy. He said we should have one dictator. He said king, but practically in modern terms it means dictator. He was against the women's liberation movement. He said it's all just cheating. It's just another, the whole society is cheating. It's just another form of cheating. That's all. He said, but we're exploited by men. So better be exploited by one man than by every man. That was Prabhupada's reply. Yes, you will be exploited because you're weaker. So you stand to be exploited. They say for the whole history, men have exploited women. Well, that just goes to show that women are less intelligent and weaker. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been exploited. And now we're coming out and we're going to have equal rights. But Prabhupada, he said that what a policewoman will do. What can she do? Niranjan Maharaj told us that they had the rules in New York. There are certain tests. You have to be strong enough to be a fireman. But then they made the rule that women can also be firemen. So now they made the rule. They changed the rules that you don't have to be so strong. But the problem is that the fire women, they're not strong enough to pick up the hose. So what's the use? Because they have to have fire women, because You know, we're all equal. But then when it comes to the fire, all they can do is blow kisses to the people in the building. They can't do anything useful. So, we love you, but as you're roasting alive there. We empathize with you. You can send, but nothing useful. So Prabhupada was pointing out these things. It's not politically correct, but Prabhupada didn't care about being politically correct. He just wanted to speak what is correct. The very term politically correct, it means that politically means it's all lies. So it's correct in the eyes of politicians means it's corrupt. That's all. Politically correct means it's a lie. That's all. That if it's correct in the eyes of politicians, then it must be a lie. So, Prabhupada wasn't concerned with this. He wasn't deliberately going against the political system, but just he happened to be speaking the truth. And what people desire to be the truth, or dress up as the truth, or pretend is the truth, is usually not the truth at all. So here's one example, that Arjuna's fighting is far more laudable than the Buddha's so-called non-violence. Of course, he introduced that principle because the principle of violence was being misused. Nindasi yagya vidheraha shruti jatam sadaya hridaya darshita pashughatam keshava dhrita buddha sharira jaya jagadishahare. Because the sacred Vedas, which are meant for uplifting human society, were being used to promote butchery of animals. Therefore, the Buddha, seeing no other way, introduced the principle of non-violence. That people were misusing the Vedas, and they're unscrupulous people and not philosophically advanced people. So instead of trying to explain to them that, yes, killing of animals is allowed in the Vedas, but only under these conditions, and is not meant for butchery, he said, oh, killing? Okay, close down the whole Vedas. Stop it all. He became an atheist, apparent atheist. Gnostic, the atheist. It actually means one who doesn't believe in the Vedas, in existence. Shunyavad means they don't accept. The Buddhist Shunyavad means they don't accept the existence of anything. So, this so-called non-violence, Prabhupada, he says, this is false magnanimity. The kshatriya, the king who beheads the murderer, is far more magnanimous than the one who spares them and gives them life imprisonment. There's this idea that there should not be capital punishment. There's another thing, Prabhupada saying, there should be capital punishment. Why? That's good for the person who's thus punished. And the king who fails to inflict capital punishment upon a murderer has to share the sinful reaction. So by not giving capital punishment to murderers, you're thinking, well, it's horrible. You kill someone who was, he killed, but why should you kill him? Then there's, so they have this idea of morality, but actually, they're inflicting more violence because that person who killed, if he's not killed in return, then he has to suffer so much life after life. So the king, simultaneously, by following the Vedic prescription to kill a murderer on the spot, he protects society from escaped murderers, from persons who kill who think that, well, if I get away, it's okay. If I don't get away, then I'll go in prison and I won't be killed. But that's a deterrent that they should be killed. So Prabhupada gave the example that in Islam, they have the Islamic law, it's actually the same as Vedic law, that a thief should have his hand cut off. And they were doing this in Afghanistan, the Taliban, and they're saying, oh, it's very bad, the Taliban, but there were no thieves. And if any thief is out of fear, and if any thief is caught, he can't steal anymore because he doesn't have a hand to steal with. It's very difficult for him to function even, because people can see he's a thief. They don't want to do anything with him. So they were saying, the Americans were saying, it's very bad, we have to go and liberate Afghanistan, which, all right, we're not pro-Taliban per se, but then what's the alternative? Your free society, it's so free that people are not safe to walk the streets in the prestigious American cities. The people, they're not protected by the kings or the police. They have to have all alarm systems and guns and dogs, and even then they're not safe. They're living in fear. So a state in which an innocent citizen lives in securely, he can leave the door of his house open and walk out with no one at home. That is far preferable to a society in which everyone is, they have so much freedom that they can loot and steal, and by legal manipulation they go to court and they get away with it. So these were some of the points that Prabhupada was making. Not politically correct, but there's this propaganda that we're brought up with, that modern society is the most advanced, and it's very liberal, and everyone can do what they like, and it's, you know, you can believe what you like. But actually, in one sense, that's favorable for our spreading Krishna consciousness, but it's not an ideal, it's not the ideal for society. Rather, society should be guided by people who know what is good. But most people are like children. You can see how easily people are misled. Someone comes up and declares, I'm God, and guaranteed he'll get some followers because people are stupid. Or they advertise Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, so popular all over the world. Why? Because people are stupid. There's nothing of any value, and it doesn't even taste nice. But just by advertising, they get people to buy. Why do people smoke cigarettes? There's absolutely nothing of any value, and it's very harmful for health, but they advertise it, and people buy it. People are stupid. The whole advertising industry works on the principle that people are stupid. So people are stupid. They require to be guided. That is the principle of Vedic society, and they require to be protected. The brahmanas are intelligent, but people in general are stupid. They need to be guided. And it's not that everyone should just be allowed to do what they like. You see the result of this. The people, they become, the society is gradually breaking down. They're not allowing people to do what they like means they should pursue the highest goal, but instead their search for happiness just ends up in sex and intoxication. And people become infatuated with movie stars and sports, and it's just insane how much importance they put on things of no importance. There's very good evidence that most of the people in the world, even those who think they're intelligent, are not at all intelligent. So society requires to be guided by force, by Kshatriyas take the force and the Brahmanas guide with intelligence. Sometimes devotees hear this and they get all notions of themselves being, you know, saviors of the world, guardians of the world, and kshatriyas, less intelligent devotees, they become fanatical like this, and they have notions of becoming kshatriyas, what they imagine a kshatriya to be. So that we're saying this doesn't mean you should, you know, go and get yourself guns and make plans for overthrowing the government or any such thing. No, the real force is not the power of the hands or the power of weapons. More powerful is the Brahma Teja, Brahminical power, and even more powerful than that is Daivi Shakti, the power of Krishna consciousness. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed that the power of love. But where love is lacking, as it generally is in this material world, then some constraint is required. But that should be guided by the principle of love. And again, love doesn't mean just some vague idea, but the parameters are defined by Shastra. So for those who don't accept Shastra, there is Astra. Astra means weapon. Hare Krishna. Is there any question about this? Yeah.
Although in Bhagavad Gita the violence is promoted, it doesn't justify the violence of Hitler and Bush. Ja sam nedavno vidio na jednom CD-u koji se zove Bhagavad Gita, interaktivni CD koji izdao BBC. Recently I saw one interactive CD, Bhagavad Gita CD, which was published by BBC.
U dijelu gdje slavni ljudi slave Bhagavad Gitu.
They have one part where famous persons praise Bhagavad Gita.
Oppenheimer, koji je tvorac atomske bombe.
Oppenheimer, who is a maker of the atomic bomb.
Kaže nakon tog događaja, neki ljudi kažu je to pozitivno i zadivljeni su ovim dijelom, neki da je negativno. Ono što ja mogu reći, ja se sjećam Bhagavad Gita i to kako je Arjuna vršio svoju dužnost.
There is a quote from Oppenheimer in which he says some people say that Bhagavad Gita is good.
No. Atomic bomb.
Atomic bomb is good or not. And I just remember what Arjuna did in Bhagavad Gita.
How he radi svoju dužnost.
He performed his duty.
Na taj način indirektno je rekao, ja sam isto radio svoju dužnost.
In this way he indirectly said that I was also performing my duty.
Ja sam malo bio uznemiren kad sam vidio taj citat, zato što on svoje nasilje opravdava sa filozofijom Bhagavad Gita, a mi smo to stavili kao slavljenje Bhagavad Gita.
I was a little disturbed by this because he is justifying his violence with Bhagavad Gita and we put this like praising Bhagavad Gita.
O tome sam pisao i BBT-o.
I wrote also about this to BBT.
Može Maharaj nešto reći o tome?
Can you say something about this?
Well, from one perspective, he was doing his duty. He, as a scientist, he was just... He was one of the team who made the atom bomb. So, as a scientist, he was following higher orders. And how they used it or misused it was not in his hands. Of course, that's on the worldly platform. One who's the servant of a bad master also becomes... He may be doing his duty, but he becomes implicated in the wrong actions of his master. Just like the washerman in Mathura. He was doing his duty when Krishna and Balaram said, give us some clothing. He did his duty by saying, this is meant for the king. You can't take that which is meant for the king. So what he was saying was right. Except that the king was Kamsa, who was a demon. And Krishna and Balaram, what they want should be followed. because their position is much higher than that of the king. So the washerman was doing his duty, and for doing his duty, he was punished by Krishna by having his head chopped off. So that's true, that Oppenheimer, from his perspective, he was doing his duty, but he was serving a bad master. You have a question? It appears so from Mahabharata. Yeah, so what's the question? Yeah, well, he's not the only devotee who's known to have eaten meat. Garuda also eats snakes. Jatayu is a vulture. So some do. It's not everyone, but some may do. Under certain circumstances. One time there was a discussion. Prabhupada was... Some Indians were talking about... I believe it was Dr. Patel who was sympathetic with the Swaminarayan Sampradaya, who are very much into non-violence. They're very moral. Their sannyasis never talk to women. And they're very, very moral people. So Dr. Patel was supporting that even if there's meat eating in the Vedas, then that's not good. And Prabhupada was blasting him, "No, you're an atheist. If the Vedas say that meat eating is allowed under certain circumstances, you have to accept that. If you don't accept that, you're an atheist." Not for us. It's not meant for us. But for certain persons under circumstances, it is allowed. And not to accept that it is allowed is another form of atheism. Yeah, please.
You said that Mahabharata, it's right in Mahabharata like this, but how much we can...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Apparently, Bhima ate meat.
But my question is...
I'm saying even if he did and it's stated in Shastra, then it may well be.
My question is, how special Vera Dostoina? I'm bona fide. How much is bona
not
fide
for you.
Mahabharata? No, Mahabharata.
How much is bona fide? Well...
Because Krishna Kshatriya Prabhu said that he is in study, in his faculty, have more of 10. I think that he said 25 bona fide Mahabharata, and Noyani is not the same.
They're not the same. According to Madhvacharya, way back, that there are interpolations. Anyway... Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam. If there's any apparent discrepancy between any other Shastra and Srimad Bhagavatam, we take the evidence of Srimad Bhagavatam. Even if it's not an interpolation, whatever is in Mahabharata is not in line with the Bhagavatam version, and we accept the Bhagavatam version. There's nothing in Mahabharata which is wrong. But we may not understand it. Not every instruction is meant for every person, every time, and every place, and every circumstance. It requires fine and subtle intelligence to understand Shastra. And that intelligence is actually spoiled by modern education. It gives us a kind of linear way of thinking instead of the multi-dimensional understanding that comes from Brahminical education. Linear, mechanical way of thinking. Mechanistic. Okay, this is the last question. Any others can go for this evening?
Hmm. yesterday you mentioned this example about this senior disciple of Srila Prabhupada who and his wife left him because she was talking to some other Matajis, and then he complained to temple president he said, you know, that's life or something like that. So I know many such examples from my own life and from also others what I heard. So it seems to me like there is no real kshatriyas or real justice in ISKCON. It's much
There's no kshatriyas.
It's much more like this.
What made you think there are any kshatriyas?
Well, if we are preaching Bhagavad Gita, like there should be justice, we should also, if somebody does something wrong in our own society,
kshatriya means he has a sword and he's ready to cut someone's head off. We don't have kshatriyas in ISKCON.
Then
there can't be justice is applied by force. We have no system of force at any level, practically. The management that goes on, it's supposed to be at a brahminical level. It's not that Brahmins don't manage or they can't manage. In traditional society, brahmanas, they manage, sannyasis managed. Not all of them, but the matadipati, the head of the mat, was a brahmana. And they had there's a big institution with so many brahmanas under them, householders and all. So, in the undefined system, or largely undefined system of ISKCON management. Some people may say the town president or the GPC is a kshatriya, but allegorically maybe, or as a reflection of, but this kshatriya means he rules by his power comes from the sword. Mao Zedong said power comes from the barrel of a gun. He understood the principle. He was a demon, but he understood the principle. But the brahminical punishment is excommunication. That's the worst they can do. You're not allowed to act as a brahmana, but they don't apply force. Another thing that the kshatriya is translated as administrator, but that's you can say indicative. They're not clerks. Pen pushers. The class who do the administrative work, the bureau, the bureaucratic work in a society, they're the kayastas. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur's kayasta class. They're like the secretaries and ministers like this. Ministers may be Brahmin by caste, but the kayastas, they're not mentioned in the four castes. But they're generally considered Shudras, although they're very intelligent and they do like the court politics and they do the practical. They admit the Kshatriyas take decisions and the kayastas, they do the. They see it's implemented and they make plans and, you know, like maybe some irrigation scheme or something like that. They see all this kind of thing. The king may give charity to brahmanas and the kayastas. They may see how much to give to each one and organize it and like this. So, management in ISKCON is, if we are to compare it to traditional Indian or Hindu or Vedic or whatever you want to call it management, it's more like brahminical management. More follows the pattern of brahminical management than the kshatriya.